And if that's the way it's planned to go, and probably that's the way it will go, but I wouldn't hesitate to sell it.
Most people in this town make their living commercial fishing, eh?
That's right.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Osterholm.
Yeah.
Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Gunderson?
Well, selling it in 1991, there'd be really a lot of people that would sell it because you're not making anything on it the way it is. I'm pretty sure there'd be a lot of people selling it if they can.
How do you feel about it yourself?
Well, I think I would sell mine too because it's not good the way it is, not making anything on it.
Okay, well, maybe since Mr. Gellman is here, we could.
I would say this, that when you or I or anyone belongs to a corporation, a profit, and hopefully you'll make a profit, you do whatever you can to protect the financial health of this corporation. This was one point against the share. Issuing a share to the members, but let's go back again. Where will you realize a dollar, Alvin, for example?
You mean if he sells his shares?
If we don't do anything, we have a Shumigan Corporation.
You're a member of the board.
Righto. Your share in the corporation is worth X many dollars, right? Do you see it? How are you going to spend it? You going to shingle your roof? Answer this question.
What difference would it make how I spent it?
Yeah, okay, that's beside the point. What are you going to do with it then? Put it in the bank?
If you don't spend it?
Oh, I might make a trip around the world if I got enough. I like to travel.
When are you going to get it?
I don't know.
Okay, neither do I. That's the question. Where do we realize any value in this gift, this grant that we got from the federal government?
You have that choice. And you can
Okay, here we are. Now, if you want to realize anything from it, then you sell it, or you get into some business where you make a big profit and you can get declare a dividend, right? We don't see the likelihood of making a hell of a lot of money, do we? Now, you talk about complaints, I'm complaining. We received something that we can't spend or use or realize. Thank you.
My question is, okay, say that it came in 1991 that that all the shareholders would get a chunk of land. How are they going to divvy out the land to each shareholder? Is it going to be a pick out of the hat type of deal, or what's going to happen there?
Well, what you get in 1991 is the right to sell your shares. You can't sell them now.
Yeah. Where's my share going to be on a pop-off head here over in Corvin? Or
No. All you get is the right to sell your share in the corporation, and someone then buys your share, the piece of paper that says you're a shareholder. The corporation still continues and still owns the land at pop-off or over here, and you walk away, having sold your shares to Mr. McMullen or Mr. Gunderson. They've given you some money. They now have more shares.
I see.
And you've got some money, and as Mr. McCollum says, you go and shingle your roof or do whatever you want to do.
There's going to be enough for that, I don't think.
Yes, Mrs. McCollum.
Will the individual corporations be able to put their own restrictions on the sale of these shares, or will that be decided?
Well, right now, not many people realize it, but right now, the corporations could impose restrictions that would go this far, that you couldn't sell, restrictions that go this far. You can sell after 1991, but your family or the corporation itself gets the first right of refusal, the right to buy them back. Well, that would have to be at fair market value, so that's the only restriction they could impose at present. But some of the proposals
be easy thing.
No.
Well, if the person wanted to sell them,
sell to the highest bidder. So that would probably take care of itself if you knew what you were going to sell. But like, say, we got $2 million or $3 million in the Shoemaking Corporation. I don't know what we got in the Aleut Corporation. But if a guy wanted to sell, what would happen to that money in there? Would he get his share out of it, whatever he's supposed to have?
I would say he would do it. Just as plain as that.
Do you want to explain that?
Well, sure, you're going to go broke, but if they don't go broke and I don't get any money out and I sold, what a couple $1 million you got in here, what's going to happen to that?
Well, I would suggest that you put a little pressure on the board of directors and see if they'd fork out a little dough every year.
Well,
it changes attitude, you know.
If you... Okay.
Yeah, excuse me. We're trying to.
Yeah.
We don't have any. Sit over here, Mr. Osterbeck. You're leading the discussion here, and
I forgot what I was going to say now.
Well, you were about to sell your shares and become very wealthy. That's where we left you.
Well, no. What I was talking about, you know, what will happen with the money, what's in the corporations. And I think Andrew said to get a dividend.
I think that's what Dickie told me there.
What was the question?
That on the interest you get on the money you got in the bank from the Shoemaking Corporation, you have to pay income tax on it.
Well, certainly that's income.
Yeah, okay. Mr. McCollum says that's income, you have to pay tax on it.
The question I was...
Yeah, just a sec.
Yes. Well, I was going to say that doesn't matter if the dividend is not tied to that. Aleut Corporation has a policy. When we make so many dollars, we give out a certain percentage of that, depending what how much our net income is each year. It's got nothing to do with the income tax at all.
Well, it does in a way. Well, I'm looking at it. But I was going to ask the question, if the Shoemaking Corporation gave out the dividends, would that be tax-free?
It wouldn't be a deduction to the corporation.
It wouldn't?
You're giving yourself the money. If I took the money out of that bank, it's
well, no.
It's not a tax deduction. No advantage whatsoever, except a goodwill.
Do you want to repeat that, Mr. McCollum? Sorry.
I'd say a dividend by the Shoemaking Corporation to its shareholders is not a tax deduction. It's a decrease in assets. And the corporation is not making any money, with the exception of interest at this point, and maybe the Aleut Corporation, where Andrew Grunholt pointed out, is making money, and they could declare a dividend to its stockholders. You are making money. Different situation than the Shoemaking Corporation.
Well, the whole thing is, like you're talking about, you have to pay taxes on it. The dividend is taxable, like you say. But if you're paying out just $100 a year, I think $100 or whatever, I don't know exactly, but at least that much is exempt from taxation. But if you're going to say they're going to pay you out $6,000-$7,000, you better see Uncle Sam.
I'm not saying that we don't pay the taxes on it. I'm asking, do the corporation have to pay taxes on it if they donate it out?
Yes.
Then you'd be taxing the same dollar twice.
Well, as it passes from me to you and you're earning income and you go, it's the same old thing.
Could I, I wonder, we've been covering a range of subjects here, and I wonder, would you like to say something? Well, I'm thinking of
I have one more comment.
Well, we'll let
don't
us get
start
the as a citizen of the United States, I resent somebody saying, you can do this with your share. You can't do this. It's restricted. We like.
Now, if you have 10 children, you leave your 100 shares to them. Each has 10 shares. If your neighbor has one child, leaves his 100 shares to his one child, his child has 100 shares. So in the second generation, you get unequal shareholding. In the next generation, it becomes even more unequal. And that's a question of principle that people have to address. And are the people with the smallest shareholdings more likely to sell, more likely to retain their shares, and so on? There's another issue that you should think about, and I don't know the answer to this. I wish somebody would tell me. Suppose the corporations buy back the shares that are sold. That means you have a diminishing number of shareholders. You could have a situation, I think, where this corporation that you have here might buy back the shares for people who wanted to sell. Those people who sell still live here. They're still part of the community. But the number of shareholders is diminishing, exercising the right to buy back, assuming they got the money to do it. So you could wind up with a very small number of people controlling the shares that of the corporation that owns a lot of the land here, and the majority of native people in the community holding no shares and having no right to say what happens on that land. And that, it seems to me, could, I don't know whether it would be here, but I've been to communities, I've been to villages, where that could be a very unhealthy state of affairs. This act, you know, just has so many features to it that baffle you as you try to thread your way through it. And the buyback thing troubles me for that. For a number of reasons, but that's when what kind of a body of shareholders are you going to have in 50 years or 25 years? Yeah.
Yeah, it's Alvin Ostrobecki. Now, when you will your shares to somebody what was born after the Land Claim Settlement Act, are they allowed to vote your stock?
Well, they are when they're 18. If they're non-native, they're not allowed to.
No, if they're native, but they weren't in there during the, you know, they're too young to be. They were born after 1971.
Oh, well, they can't. No, they can't because they're too young to vote the stock.
No, when they get old enough, if you turn the stock over to them.
Oh, yeah, when they're old enough, they can.
So I thought something was brought up about that earlier. Only if you sell it to somebody that's not a native, then they couldn't vote.
Not until after 1991.
Oh, anybody can vote then.
Yeah. After 1991.
Anyway. Yeah, I guess that's what we talked about. Okay.
Excuse
me. I'd like to inject something into that. Isn't there a possibility that the corporation can change their bylaws and still restrict the voting rights to non-native and non-native after 1991?
Yeah. Yes, there is.
Would that be a simpler way to do it? Would that have to be a 2/3 majority of the stockholders, or what?
Right now, I think you can do it by 50% majority. But after 1991, I think you'll need 2/3 to do it. Remember this, though. Anything that... give you corporations instead. Well, 13 years later, the mind of man has devised ideas that go beyond those two conceptions, and perhaps something else can be worked out.
Isn't entirely relevant to this hearing, but something else that I heard as I wandered through town was that this is definitely a man's town, and I don't know, looking at the people who are here, I'm not sure whether or not that's true, or whether it might not be true. but I don't know if anyone wants to comment on that. I said it probably doesn't.
I would like to present an hypothesis, you might say. The worst thing that could happen to the land, let's go back and say that 51% of it was sold to a private organization or an oil company, a very selfish company, and you would like to go over to Left Hand Bay and stand on the bank and catch a salmon. I would like to step ashore in Kegion, or you would like to go to Canoe Bay and hunt a caribou, and they say no. Could that happen?
Sure, if it's their land.
It could happen right now, with your own people.
Mm-hmm. Your own corporation.
Unlikely. It's more apt to happen with a private company from Pennsylvania or someplace, wouldn't it? If they were able to buy 51% of the Shumigan Corporation, then they would say, you keep off that land. Under no conditions are you allowed to step on that land. That's what could happen.
Yeah, it could. The Shumigan Corporation right now can tell certain people that they can't do that. So it doesn't have to be an oil company.
Yeah, I was talking about the members, the shareholders. They would tell, they could tell everybody not to step on it. If I didn't sell mine and 51% of the shareholders sold, the board and the president could do anything they'd like, wouldn't they? Even say shareholders cannot step on there anymore. Of course, they could be replaced, but the majority of shareholders would rule. They own 51% of the share. They'll elect their own board. They'll make the rules. And the 49% natives stand there with their mouth open, wondering what happened. I guess this is the worst thing that could happen, and this is what this meeting is all about, what we're going to do to prevent
that from
bad
happening.
Things from happening.
Right. It'll never happen. The Shumigan Corporation don't have enough money to put the guards out to keep the guys off their land. And the oil companies would be too busy, they wouldn't bother about it. They want friends up here because they're going to drill all over for oil.
That was just an example.
Yeah.
But mining people, they aren't as friendly as oil people. You go over to the mine over there, if they don't like the looks of you, they'll tell you to bug off. In fact, they have chased people off their property.
You had your hand up, huh?
I'm trying to think. Well, the main theme of this is trying to, how are you going to hold on to the land after 1991 and the transfer of stocks? This got nothing to do with all these other little things we're discussing.
Right.
Sorry, what other little things?
Well, they were talking about chasing guys off the land.
Oh, well, no, but Mr. McMullen is really just putting forward a worst-case scenario. McCallum, I mean, and that's just thinking through the implications of what happens, which is...
What happens now, say, up on the Aleut region, North Slope, southeastern Alaska, some of those decide down there they're going to restrict their stock and they're going to head on to their land, and somebody else has a different version than the Aleut Corporation. I mean, the Aleut region has a different version of it. How are they going to resolve it? Each one can do whatever they want, each region?
Well, right now, each region, each village can bring in a buyback provision. This village could adopt a buyback provision. The village that Mr. Gunderson represents, a little village, I've forgotten the name of it, they might not. Well, everyone might have its own particular variation. When I talked about options, I was talking about all of these options from corporations to IRA governments to other kinds of trust arrangements and so on that that have come up at the meetings we've had.
Well,
But right now you've got a range of options if you want to adopt them.
So where does the AFN fit on that? They seem to be doing their own thing.
Well, they're quite naturally looking at how to deal with 1991. And I think they have a series of six proposals that they've circulated around the state. And I can well imagine that they're concerned about 1991 and want to develop a series of carefully thought out proposals.
But do they get input from each village then? All the way out the chain and all around the area?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a member of the AFN.
Yeah, well, I just wondered how they did that. It was just their own thinking, or do they get out to the villages and try and get a feeling of how they feel about it?
Well, they've had retreats to which they've invited people from around the state.
They don't get all the people that way.
Well, let me put it this way. I think this commission is the only outfit that's going around to the villages, but the AFN is well aware of what we're doing and subscribed to the transcripts, and I'm sure will read my recommendations.
Well, this is the first concrete thing I've seen of somebody really coming here and talking to people about it, and I think when you leave here, I think whoever came to this meeting here will understand it much better. And does what you hear here, this will be fed into the AFN too?
Well, this transcript that is made,
yeah.
they get a copy. But, I mean, nobody can sit down and read it day after day. We have it so that it's available for reference. We have it so that I can go back to it in working on my report and say to myself, I remember those people at get shares when their parents die or their grandparents. Now that means that somebody maybe has 10 children, leaves their shares to the 10 children in equal proportions. So if you have 10 children, you leave them your shares. Each child has 10 shares. But on the other hand, your next door neighbor might have one child and leave that child 100 shares. All these students will realize how good I am at arithmetic. But I think I figured that out. That means that in the second generation, the shareholdings are unequal. And then maybe in the third generation, they become even more unequal, with some people holding just one share. They actually now have in the corporations shareholders who hold less than one share. So you would have a body of shareholders, all of them native shareholders, but holding different quantities of shares. And some people are just a little troubled by that. Does that make any difference to you? Do you think it matters at all?
I think it does matter, because they should just put it with who they're going to give it to personally, you know. Mm-hmm. I wish that these students would speak up.
Well,
they're in stock. If they're shareholders, yeah, they should speak out what they feel in their mind.
Well, I suppose there are some families in Unalaska where the children who are 14 and 15 hold shares and the children who are 9 and 10 don't hold shares. I suppose that must be true here. If it is, I'd like maybe some of the students could tell me about it. Maybe you might just pass the microphone along the back row there, Mary, and just see if anyone would like to chat.
Hey, I'm Denise Rankin. I live here, and I'm a shareholder, and I don't know anything about this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are a shareholder, so you have shares. You may not know anything about this, and sometimes that's the feeling I have about it, but do you... Do you ever go to meetings of the corporation in which you have shares?
I don't know. Once.
Once.
I just did once.
Oh, I see. And was there any particular reason why you went that time?
Well, I had to go with my mom.
Oh, I see. Well, I guess that's a pretty good reason. Well... What do you think about the fact that children like yourself that were born before December 18th, 1971 have 100 shares, and children who have born after that don't have any?
Go to meeting, but it costs you about, let's see, it's, I don't know what it is now, but close to 400 just one way to Anchorage. It costs you about $700 just for an airplane ticket to go to this meeting.
Right.
Lands person here, maybe he can tell us something about the city and the land and the corporation.
Maybe something about section 14C3, if that's...
Well, I don't know how much I can impart on 14C3. The city of Unalaska has received the reconveyance from the Unalaska Corporation under 14C3.
The 1,280 acres.
The 1,280 acres, yes. And now there are portions that the Unalaska Corporation is looking at. One in particular is that under 14C3, 5 acres, which contain the cemetery, was conveyed to the city. And now the Unalaska Corporation would like to possibly exchange 5 acres elsewhere, so that the corporation and the native people may have their cemetery back. The question now that's being researched is, are we capable of going back the way the agreement was written between the two entities and have a land exchange? Yes, ma'am.
When was it sold to the city?
It wasn't sold to the city. It was conveyed under the terms of the Claims Act 14C3 as a part of the reconveyance of lands to the municipality. And now the city has been approached by the Unalaska Corporation about conveying that land back, which I think from everything I've heard, everybody's in agreement. No, it wasn't sold. It was. This was before I got here. This the agreement was signed in January of 1979. And
What have the relations been between the city and the Unalaska Corporation? Have they been good?
Well, I can only speak to that question from August of 83 when I got here. I would say in the 14 months that I've been associated with the city and associated with the corporation, that the two get along quite well. Previous to being here, I was up in the Bristol Bay borough area at NACNAC, and the relationship between the borough government and the Bristol Bay Native Corporation was quite a bit different from here, quite a bit more hostile. But I think the two entities here are trying to work together, and I think it's been a real good relationship so far. But that is my opinion.
Yeah. What's your official job with the city?
My title is the director of planning.
The city and the corporation and I think BLM are involved in some litigation with respect to Haystack.
Yes, ma'am.
Could you tell Judge
Berger
a little bit about that?
When Mr. George Gustafson was the town site trustee with BLM, and it was in the late 70s, a portion of United States Survey 4988 was deeded over to the city from the federal government, and the city held a land auction and several parcels of ground were sold. After that time, and probably after the Lignagic suit was begun,
The jurisdiction of the federal government and the state government to legislate under the Constitution, and the people of Alaska acknowledge the jurisdiction of those two governments, including the native people. They acknowledge the jurisdiction of those two governments, and the question whether Alaska should have been decolonized in 1958 by giving it a choice. That is, by saying, do you want to be an independent country? Do you want to be a state of the Union? Do you want to continue as a territory? Is not something that anyone believes can be raised now. I can tell you that in my travels around the state at these meetings, I've had some Native people raise that very question. I think that just last week, one young Native person got up and suggested that Alaska Natives should separate from the United States and form their own country. I told him that it was something that I didn't think was in the cards, and that it might be, that I thought it would be more useful to think about what can be done about the ANCSA and the other provisions made by Congress. The interesting thing is that the rights of Alaska Natives and of Native people in every country of the West are based on international law. The great American Chief Justice John Marshall developed the whole idea of Native sovereignty and Native Aboriginal title, as we know it, in the 1820s and 1830s. And he developed that notion by bringing international law in and making it the basis for what then became the law of the United States. And then Canada adopted Marshall's ideas, and Australia has adopted them, and the Scandinavian countries in dealing with their own indigenous populations have adopted Marshall's ideas. Now, many legal thinkers feel that we have exhausted Marshall's ideas. It's a tribute to him that they've served reasonably well for 150 years. Now, many people believe we should be bringing international law back in, because, and of course, international law has changed. In John Marshall's day, if a European power sailed along the Aleutian chain and said, "We've discovered this, we claim it, it's ours," under international law, it became theirs. Now, the International Court of Justice at The Hague has ruled in the case of Western Morocco that neither Morocco nor Spain, by simply discovering what is known as Western Morocco, where there are tribesmen living who claim it is theirs, that the theory of discovery is no longer valid in international law. And that is why some legal scholars
regional against a regional, or a village against a village. They say the act was made by lawyers for lawyers, and I think that's a good statement. The other problem that I'd like to speak on is that, and you said it's been brought up throughout the state, is after 1971, the you're no longer an Aleut or an Indian or an Eskimo. You're just, that's it, according to the Act. You had to be born and enrolled by 1971. There's no provisions in after that date set up for children born after that time.
You said that you were involved before ANCSA came about. What did you want to achieve in a land claim settlement? If you could turn the clock back to 1970 and write your own land claim settlement, what would you write? What do you think people really wanted to do?
I don't really know what people wanted to do, because I was not in the village at that time. I was in the lower 48. I think what the people wanted to do, this is just my idea, is preserve their rights with regarding land. And how they came up with the corporation part, I don't really know, because that part I wasn't familiar with. That's why I think that if that was the essence of the act, was self-determination through control of their own lands, then 1991 is too close, because some of the organized corporations, as I said, the village corporations, aren't even ready now in this day to do what they're going to have to. They should be planning right now, and they're so busy surviving, they don't have time to or the money to plan for 1991. So, as I said, I don't know, and I can't remember that. It's too far, but I think the essence behind it was preservation of land. And it appears that 1991, well, I can see, and I've said this many times to the board, that if we don't ever issue a stockholder a dividend, come 1991 and somebody offers them $10,000, what are you going to do if the land has never done anything for you, or if the corporation has never done anything for you? Probably by 1991. I think in this, in the case of the Lucians, maybe we're a little bit different. Is that we're not a land subsisting person; we're water oriented people. We don't have anything to subsist off the land out here, but the water, which we don't have really control over, is where, you know, the fish and the seal and, yeah, come from.
Yeah.
Getting back to surface and subsurface, the other part that I'd like to speak to, and maybe it's speaking to the regionals, is that we would like the time to plan, land, have land use plan.
When 1991 comes, how will it be possible to determine what a share is worth? There's been no market for 20 mm-hmm. years. That is, the shares can't be sold, so there aren't people out there saying, I'll give you this or I'll give you that. So there's no way of determining what the fair market value is. Well, in 1991, if the shares are up for sale, then presumably offers will be made, and it will be the estimate of what those people who make offers for the shares, their estimate of what they think the corporation is worth in terms of its assets and the land it holds. But one problem is this, that some of these corporations still haven't finished selecting their land, and it's pretty hard to know what a corporation is worth when it hasn't yet got in all the assets it's entitled to. So that's a problem about fair market value. The other thing you mentioned is the buyback. Right now, the corporations could, by resolution of their shareholders, under the law as it stands now, they could require that their shareholders sell to them. That is, if the shareholders want to sell after 1991, they have to sell to the corporation. So the question arises, well, could the corporations pay for the shares? But the question of fair market value comes in, because if they couldn't pay fair market value, the shareholder would be entitled to sell to anybody. But there's another business about the buyback. I'm not asking you to comment on it, but those people who spoke earlier might think about it. If the corporation buys back the shares from those who sell out, you could in some villages wind up with the majority of people having sold their shares and the minority, perhaps a very few people, still holding shares, controlling the corporation, controlling the land. Now, that's the way business works, and if people sell their shares, then they can't complain after that. But it could, it seems to me, in some ways lead to an unhappy situation if just a few people remained in the corporation holding the shares, controlling the corporation, and holding all the land that everybody used to own before, the others having sold out. I just ask you to think about it. I don't know the answer to it, and but the trouble with this act is that every time you think you've thought of a solution, it seems to spawn a bunch more problems. And I might just comment on the one of the things that Margaret Lekanoff raised. I've read those six proposals, and they're interesting proposals. And the one about the land bank, to put all the land in the land bank, is one way of avoiding taxation. The trouble is, at the moment, there isn't any federal policy on land banks, and there's no state land banking legislation. But certainly that's all there is right now. But there are other ways of avoiding taxation that it might be wise to consider. And the state agreed that it would not impose any property tax on the land. Nobody came along and said, oh, you, this is what you did in 1971 in Alaska. This is what you've got to do in Maine. It seems to me that you can always go back to Congress and say, look, you acknowledged in the Maine settlement that things have changed, that ideas are working into the whole texture of native claims, and you should recognize them in our case. But maybe the best argument is this, in 1887, Congress passed a law designed to enable the Indians of the lower 48 to sell their land, all their reservation land. It meant that after 25 years had passed, it sounds like angst, doesn't it? They could divide up the reservations, everybody gets a lot, and the surplus land from the reservations was then sold to the white settlers who were coming in. But as a lot of people predicted at the time, that Indian land, more and more of it was lost, and in 50 years, they had lost half of all the land they held throughout the United States. And when President Roosevelt came in 1933, his administration stopped it, and they repealed that law, and so that they could keep what they still had left. They had half their land left, and the Roosevelt administration also set aside money to buy back land, more land, to replace the land the Indians had lost. Well, I mention that to show that if you've got a good enough case, I'm sure the government, Congress, will listen. But it's nothing new to change these things.
In your travels, are you finding support for this sort of thing? Or I guess we need to be looking at other people rather than them looking at us. In your visits around Alaska, what sort of reactions are you getting?
Well, in some places I've been, I can tell you there is deep resentment about ANCSA. People say, almost in bewilderment, look, our land claims were settled back in 1971. That was the whole purpose, to settle it. It's the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And now we're told it wasn't settled, that we could still lose it all, and it's the Settlement Act that may well be the instrument by which we'll lose our land. So there is a lot of resentment. People in some villages feel the corporations have served them well, but in most villages people feel that they have received very little from the corporations. That is, there has been little in the way of dividends. Very few of them are employed by the corporations. So they say, well, what does all of this mean to us? But their principal concern is the land. They want to keep the land for subsistence. And I haven't yet been to a village that said,
valuable. People want to keep the land.
and yet the language and the customs are passing away. Over the next 20, 50, 100 years, many things may change, but how, if the Aleut people want to remain distinct and feel Aleut with the biological lines being diluted perhaps by intermarriage, what provision other than keeping land, which has nothing about how people act or treat their children or speak or regard the land, how can that provide the key? Isn't language and custom equally important, and can't they be maintained without so much worry about the federal government? Doesn't that take organization by the people themselves simply to maintain it within themselves? And isn't that something that only they can do and that no one else can do for them, with or without money, land, or rights? It's simply a matter of individual determination.
Yes, thank you, Mike. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of truth in that. These are profound questions going to someone's sense of individual and collective identity, and often not easy to articulate. But I've found wherever I've gone that people feel that the loss of native land in Alaska would be a tragedy. That much at least seems plain, and we go on from there. Well, would anybody else like to say anything tonight? Well, let me thank you all for coming tonight. We started yesterday at Sand Point, and in our trip to the Aleutians, and we had a meeting there yesterday afternoon and yesterday evening, and a very lively discussion, we've now had a very good day here this afternoon and this evening. 30 people have spoken here this afternoon and this evening altogether, and it's been very helpful to me. Tomorrow we're holding a meeting at Akutan, and then we're going to St. Paul at the end, later in the week, so that we will, I hope, have a good idea about how people here in the Aleutians and the Pribilofs feel about these questions. So I want to thank you. I find that as I go around the state, the whole picture seems to be coming together piece by piece. I hope it is. And this meeting tonight has been helpful in putting together one of the pieces anyway. And I think if we all talk about these things and think about them, we'll come up with some answers. So I will be writing my report in the spring, and it'll be made public next summer, and it'll be sent to you, and I hope it will be useful to you. So thanks again, and the meeting stands adjourned.
Additional comments anytime between now and early in the next year, they're welcome to send them to our offices. And if anyone would like a business card, I'll put a stack over here. We'd appreciate that.
Yes.
I don't do the transcribing. We give these professional transcribers. They don't.